To do today is to continue talking about muscle. And last time we talked about how the nervous system was organized, a little bit about muscle, and how the nerve system was connected to the muscle system. Or, from the muscle point of view, how the muscles are innervated. This is how it's spelled. To be innervated is to be without energy. To be innervated is to get input from a nerve. So one way to look at this is to make a table of the difference between what gives with skeletal muscle and with smooth muscle. And I'm going to start this, and I may fill it in further as we go, so you might want to leave some space. Now, we already said that the nerves going into the skeletal muscle are motor neurons, so that it's innervated by the somatic nervous system. But what connects to smooth muscle is the autonomic nervous system. Now, there's a consequence of this. The somatic nervous system releases always acetylcholine, and it's always excitatory. The receptor is a channel. It's always open in response to a signal. But it's different with an autonomic nervous system, which, remember, has a two-nerve relay, not one. And at the end of the second nerve, there is more than one possible neurotransmitter. It could be acetylcholine or norepinephrine. And these can have either excitatory or inhibitory effects. Because these receptors are not themselves channels, these are indirect, the receptors for these compounds at the synapse on the smooth muscle, the receptors are indirect metabotropic receptors. And that means that they trigger second messengers. The second messengers can open channels, close channels, do all kinds of things. But the result of all this is that the signal to the target smooth muscle can be either stimulatory or inhibitory. So if we wanted to put it that way, we could say direct receptors, indirect. Now, the only thing, as we mentioned last time, that gives signals about contraction to skeletal muscle is the somatic nervous system. But smooth muscle also gets input from hormones as well as neurotransmitters. So these are the two neurotransmitters, but they're also signals from hormones. Now, we talked a little bit about calcium last time. In order for a muscle to contract, any kind, there has to be a higher amount, a spike of calcium in the cytoplasm, in the cytosol, the soluble cytoplasm. And the question is, where does that calcium come from? And we explained that in skeletal muscle, it is released from inside the cell, from the ER. But in smooth muscle, sometimes the calcium comes from the ER, but sometimes it comes from the outside. As we'll see, a lot of the differences here have to do with the fact that a smooth muscle cell is quite small. So to get a signal of some kind from one side to the other all the way throughout the cell is not a big deal. However, skeletal muscle cells, you remember, are very large. So to get a signal all through the cell simultaneously so that all the fibers can contract together is complicated. And so there are structures for that. Now, there's another major issue here which is different between the two of them. Smooth muscle can be stimulated from the outside by the autonomic nervous system or by hormones. But some smooth muscle contracts without any outside stimulus at all. And the reason for that is it has pacemaker cells. Both striated muscle and smooth muscle have pacemakers. Now, I didn't put striated muscle or heart or cardiac. I meant cardiac. I didn't put a third category here, although we talked about it last time, that cardiac muscle is the third category. And cardiac muscle is in some ways like skeletal, in that it's striped, it's striated. It has the same sort of arrangement of actin and myosin. But it's like smooth muscle in that it has pacemakers. Now, not every cell in either smooth muscle or cardiac muscle is a pacemaker. But some of the cells are. They have their own intrinsic rhythm. That's why they're called pacemakers. And when they fire off all the rest of the cells. And I want to talk a little bit about pacemakers and how they work. Now, the easiest way to do this is to look at handout 19C at the bottom. You have to turn it sideways. That we have three little graphs here. And these are measurements of membrane potential with time. Now, if you were looking at an ordinary muscle cell or the axon of a nerve cell, what would it look like? You can fire an action potential in the membrane of a muscle cell or in a neuron in its axon. And what does potential look like with time? You have a standard resting potential. When you get the right stimulus, the cell depolarizes. It depolarizes to threshold, and then it fires an action potential. This is the famous picture of what an action potential looks like. So first the cell is at its resting membrane potential. Then it depolarizes to threshold, and then you get an action potential or a spike. Now, if you look back to 19C, where you have what it looks like in a pacemaker cell, you see that it's quite different. The picture looks like this. And I could keep repeating. Now, what's different here? You notice that there is no stable resting membrane potential. The cell does not sit at a polarized level waiting for a stimulus. The cell depolarizes without any input until it hits threshold, and then it fires an action potential. So the action potential part looks sort of the same. But instead of having a standard resting membrane potential, it has a part where it spontaneously, slowly depolarizes, and that's what's called the pacemaker potential. Now, how does this work? We have discussed in a regular neuron, in an axon, and it's similar in a muscle cell membrane, how you get your standard action potential. Dr. Feierstein discussed what channels open and close and what ions move around. Now, in order to get a different pattern, as in a pacemaker cell, different ions have to move because different channels open and close. So the next picture shows you what ions move around to achieve these changes in potential. And the third picture tells you what channels have to be opened or closed in order to pull this off. So what is happening, and I'll just draw the ions on the second, on this first picture, that at this point, why is the cell depolarizing? Because there's more positive charge building up inside the cell. And that's primarily due, as you can see from the picture, of first sodium and then calcium coming in. So first sodium channels must open, and then calcium. Now, depending on which authorities you read, there are slightly different explanations and what's going on, and there may be multiple factors here. It's also possible that not only does more sodium and calcium come out than usual, but it's possible that less potassium comes out. So if more, I'm not sure I said that right, if more sodium and calcium go in or less potassium comes out, you get the same net effect, too much plus building up in the cell, and the cell depolarizes. So it's probably a combination of all of these causes the cell to depolarize. And then once it hits threshold, you get an inrush of positive, and that's corrected by potassium leaving. Now, just as with a regular action potential, the way you get back to your normal hyperpolarization is by potassium channels opening and potassium leaving the cell. But what is different about pacemakers is that what rushes in to cause the spike is calcium and not sodium. How could you get a spike out of calcium? You can get a spike out of sodium. But you can't get a spike out of potassium. Why should that be? So why don't you just talk about that for 30 seconds or so and see if we all agree. Why can you get a spike out of calcium or sodium, but not potassium? Look at this. If you open potassium channels, which way does the potassium tend to go? It tends to go out. If you open sodium channels, which way does sodium tend to go? What about calcium? It also goes in. So you can calculate all of this from the Nernst equation, or you can figure it out simply from the fact that since the cell is slightly negative on the inside, positive ions would normally be pulled in. But their concentration gradients can be in the same or the opposite direction. The concentration gradient for potassium is in the opposite direction, and it overwhelms, to some extent, the electrical push. But for calcium and sodium, there's so much more outside that both the chemical and the electrical push are in. So if you open either calcium or sodium gates, they will both rush into the cell and cause a spike. And then you open the potassium gates, and the potassium goes out, and you get back to where you started. And then the cell just starts depolarizing again until it hits threshold. So what are the channels involved here? The very third panel tells you about the channels. As you might expect here, calcium channels for the spike part, calcium channels open to cause the depolarization, potassium channels open to get the hyperpolarization. But if you look down here about the pacemaker potential, it says something about IF channels open. Now, the F stands for funny. These are called funny sodium channels. And the reason for that is, when does your normal voltage-gated sodium channel open? Let's come back to here. Where does your normal voltage-gated sodium channel open? It opens around here when you hit threshold. Is that depolarized or hyperpolarized? Notice once the cell gets positive, towards positive, depolarized, that kicks off the opening. But what kicks off the opening here? What causes these sodium channels to open that cause the pacemaker potential? They open when the cell is hyperpolarized. So these are a different kind of sodium channel. It's voltage gated, but it's a different voltage trigger. And so since it's gated at a funny, peculiar voltage from the point of view of a normal action potential, they're called funny channels. Okay, so the point really of all this is that what kind of potential you'll get, what kind of depolarization, depends on what ions move, and that depends on what kind of channels you have. Okay, now we know that in the heart there are pacemaker cells. And because there are pacemaker cells present, that's why the Lowy experiment is doable. You can put an isolated heart in a beaker and it will continue to beat, because the pacemaker cells will continue to fire action potentials, and that will cause the contractile cells to fire action potentials, and the muscle will contract. But we also know from the Lowy experiment that there are actually nerves here. There are actually two. We know about one from that experiment. There's input from the parasympathetic, and there's input from the sympathetic. One releases acetylcholine, and the other releases norepinephrine. One makes the heart beat faster, one makes the heart beat slower. In the Lowy experiment, they were dealing with the parasympathetic nerve only. Now, how does that work? The neurotransmitters that are released are picked up by receptors on the pacemaker cells. And those receptors open or close channels which affect the slope of the pacemaker potential. Let's see how this would work. If we open more funny channels, what's going to happen? Are we going to make this steeper or shallower? It's going to be steeper because more sodium is going to come in, and so we're going to reach thresholds sooner, and so we're going to fire action potentials more often, and we're going to get a faster heartbeat. Acetylcholine has the opposite effect. These neurotransmitters affect other things as well, but the primary thing that they affect is the opening or closing of the channels responsible for the pacemaker potential. And therefore, they change the slope of the potential, the time it takes to reach threshold, and the frequency of action potentials, and the frequency of heartbeat. And hormones also can have these effects. So that's really all I wanted to say about pacemakers, which are found in some smooth muscle and in cardiac muscle. And I wanted to now talk about the actual details of contraction. How do these cells actually contract? But before I do that, let me ask if there are questions before I go on. Yeah?
How do hormones work?
Well, there are receptors for the hormones on the surface of the pacemaker cells. Some of them are the same as the hormone, as the receptors for these neurotransmitters. But since, and these receptors are metabotropic receptors, G-protein coupled receptors, they trigger second messenger pathways, and that opens and closes channels and has other effects. So I think what we'll do now then is we're going to go on and consider how do muscle actually contract. Now we've already said that this is sort of a differences table. We said last time something about similarities. We know that all muscles use calcium as a signal for contraction. But as is indicated here, the calcium doesn't always come from the same place, and so you have to sort of figure that out. Also, whenever you have contraction, it means that actin is sliding relative to myosin. So they all have actin and myosin, and they all slide. But how calcium triggers this is different. Both what protein, so the source of the calcium is different, And also, what protein binds the calcium is different. And another way to look at this is not just what does that calcium binding do, but in order to get contraction, actin and myosin have to get it together. They have to form a bridge. Now, in some muscle, the actin has to be altered in order to do contact myosin. And in some muscle, the myosin has to be activated to contact the actin. It's different in the two major kinds of muscle, striated and smooth, as we'll explain. So that's another thing to keep your eye on, is which one is altered. And it turns out that in one case, the alteration is a covalent modification, phosphorylation again. And in one case, it's just a conformational change due to binding to something else. So how is it altered? So we want to look at these. Okay, we know that you need calcium, you slide the actin by the myosin, you have to use ATP. But what are the details of it? In smooth muscle, we'll do first, and then we'll do skeletal muscle. Now, I explained last time that smooth muscle is not a skeletal muscle wannabe. It is, in fact, a very important organ which serves very important functions. It does things skeletal muscle can't do. It can maintain an intermediate level of contraction, what people call tone, for very long periods of time with low input of energy, without which you couldn't function. It's true that skeletal muscle cannot develop, smooth muscle cannot develop the force of skeletal muscle, but it, in the long run, does things that you can't get done otherwise. But the reason we're going to talk about it first is that the structure of skeletal muscle is a lot simpler. So you want to look now at handout A. If you turn it sideways, it has a whole bunch of diagrams about smooth muscle. And the one at the bottom shows you sort of the structure of the issues here. That remember, smooth muscle cells are relatively small, ordinary muscle size, and they have actin and myosin inside. But the actin and the myosin are in bundles. Now, in all of the muscles, the actin is attached to something. So here, there are these anchoring structures here, and the actin is attached to them. And these are called dense bodies, and you can see them in the picture. It's a little different in, this is what smooth muscle looks like. We'll go into the details more later, but in skeletal muscle, the setup is more like this. Same idea, actin is attached to a rigid point, but the rigid point is called the Z-line. It's made up of several proteins. Now, in both cases, the actin is in, the myosin is in between. So let's put the myosin in. The myosin overlaps with the actin. And when the muscle contracts, the overlap gets larger. So if we had actin and myosin like this, when the muscle contracts, the overlap gets larger, and the spaces where there was only one or the other get smaller. Now, in skeletal muscle, the actin and the myosin and the Z line are all lined up in a regular register, and that's why you get those stripes. In smooth muscle, the bundles are not arranged in such a regular way. And as a result, the muscle looks, if you look back, it looks sort of like a worm in a mesh bag. So the dense bodies would be here, and the bundles would be connected to the dense bodies. But in addition, these lines that are shown here in the cell represent intermediate filaments. And the intermediate filaments apparently hold the dense bodies and the bundles in a fairly strong way. They keep them oriented, so they're not just floating around in the cell. Now, what happens when the cell contracts? When the actin slides past the myosin, what's going to happen is that the dense bodies are going to be pulled closer to each other. And so what you get is like the shorter picture underneath. People refer to this as a worm in a mesh bag. Here's the extended form. When you sort of contract the mesh, you get the squeezed picture underneath it. So you have both intermediate filaments and actin connected to the dense bodies. Now, we should probably mention something else, that when people first looked at muscle, it was very clear that the myosin fibers were thicker than the actin. And so the actin is often referred to as the thin filaments, while the myosin is called the thick filament. And these terms are used interchangeably with myosin and actin. So there are bundles or arrangements of thick and thin. Now, that's the basic setup. How does the input come into this muscle from the autonomic nervous system to tell it to contract? Now, you may not have noticed at the time, but we had an earlier handout that showed the pre- and postsynaptic sides of a neuron and a muscle. So a neuron, muscular synapse. And the structures were quite elaborate on both sides. So if you're talking about a nerve-muscle synapse, where we mean nerve-skeletal muscle, first of all, you have that structure where you have the axon, and then you have a bouton or a synaptic ending, and then you have a very special structure on the postsynaptic side. You have a structure which is usually called an end plate, and it has a very complicated structure in order to generate an action potential. Now, one way to think about it is that if you have a somatic nerve connecting to a skeletal muscle, the skeletal muscle, remember, is huge. And so we have to have special structures here to, in fact, trigger contraction of the whole muscle. But in the case of smooth muscle, the cell is quite small. And so you don't need such a fancy structure either on the presynaptic side or on the postsynaptic side. And the picture on your handout shows a smooth muscle consisting of individual cells, but the cells are connected, you may notice, by gap junctions. They're these little picked things that look like this. These are meant to be gap junctions. And that means that if one of those cells is one or a few of those cells are in fact pacemaker cells, then if the pacemaker cell changes its membrane potential, so will everybody else. So this is, notice, a lot of individual smooth muscle cells all connected by gap junctions. So when you trigger one cell to contract, they all will. What do you call that? Is that single unit or multi-unit muscle? This is single unit, because it all contracts as a unit. So this is single unit. And here are the neurons connecting to it from the autonomic nervous system. Now you notice that this muscle gets input not just from one kind of neuron, a motor neuron, but from two kinds. It gets input both from the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. And instead of having a single bulb or bouton at the end of the axon, you have these little swellings as it goes. And they contain the vesicles which release neurotransmitter onto the surface of the muscle. And as it's labeled on the handout, these are called axon varicosities. They contain the neurotransmitter in vesicles. It's released by exocytosis. And you don't have any really fancy postsynaptic structure in the muscle, but there is something you have to have. This muscle is going to react to a neurotransmitter. What does it have to have? It has to have receptors. So there are going to be receptors located in the membrane at the appropriate intervals. Now, once the appropriate neurotransmitter comes along, and you fire an action potential in this muscle, these muscle cells, how does that cause them to contract? That has to lead to the release of calcium, or an inrush of calcium. And then, so what? What does that do? And the little picture in the middle shows you the series of events of how calcium leads to myosin being in shape to move relative to actin. So we want to look at that picture more closely. Now we've met most of the pieces here, but we've never put them together. Now, in a way, maybe we should start near the bottom. We've got inactive myosin kinase. And we've got it goes to active myosin kinase. This is actually the kinase that we referred to a long time ago, or last time. This is myosin light chain kinase. And we already said that using the cyclic AMP pathway, you can inhibit contraction of smooth muscle. Because we said that using the cyclic AMP pathway, you get relaxation of muscle, smooth muscle, and that using the IP3 pathway, you get contraction. And you may remember we said that some smooth muscle responds one way to epinephrine, and some responds the other. What's the difference? When you add epinephrine, the smooth muscle around your bronchioles relaxes, and the smooth muscle around your peripheral arterioles contracts. Same signal, but two different pathways get triggered. Why? What's different? Well, these two smooth muscle cells are in different locations, but how do they know they're in different locations? This makes sense, what happens here. But why do they respond differently? They have to have a different protein. And what is that protein?
Activating or inhibiting G protein.
It's the G protein, but what triggers the G protein? It's the receptor. The critical difference is that they have different G protein coupled receptors that respond to epinephrine. Receptor 1, receptor 2. Those receptors in turn trigger different G proteins. Now both G proteins may be in the same cell, but only one of them gets triggered by the appropriate receptor. So the appropriate receptor triggers the appropriate G protein that activates either adenyl cyclase or phospholipase C, and you get either cyclic AMP or IP3, etc. Now, we understand that IP3 causes release of calcium from the ER, and calcium activates all this. So maybe we should put that in first. Calcium, in this case, doesn't act by itself. It has to bind to that famous protein calmodulin, which is responsible for many of the actions of calcium, and the two come together to form a complex. And it is that complex that actually binds to the kinase, the myosin light chain kinase, and changes its conformation so that it becomes active. And now, it's the active myosin light chain kinase which allows contraction. And it does that, you see its name, myosin kinase? Because in this case, we have to phosphorylate myosin to get it to do anything. So this is a case where it's the myosin that we're going to alter, and we're going to do it covalently. So this kinase, using ATP in the usual way, is going to convert inactive myosin to phosphorylated myosin, which can now stick to actin and cause contraction. So now we see if you add calcium, what happens? Or, to go all the way back, if you add epinephrine to a cell with the right receptor, it triggers the IP3 pathway, which causes calcium release from the ER. So that calcium binds to calmodulin. The complex binds to myosin kinase. The myosin kinases, or adds phosphate to myosin, and now we're actually ready for contraction. Now, how does cyclic AMP block this? We said, actually, that cyclic AMP phosphorylates the myosin kinase and puts it out of commission. So what the cyclic AMP pathway does, using pKa, is to phosphorylate myosin light chain kinase. And that's inactive. Now, if the myosin light chain kinase is inactive, will calcium have an effect? Calcium calmodulin has to combine with the unphosphorylated form in order to get it to do anything. So by phosphorylating myosin lysate kinase, we basically put it out of the way, can't use it, and calcium has no effect. So that's how the cyclic AMP pathway prevents the muscle from contracting, by knocking the kinase here out of commission. Now, in general, in smooth muscle, the calcium sometimes comes from the ER, and sometimes it comes from the outside through the opening of channels in the plasma membrane. Usually more of it comes from the outside, but some of it can come from the ER. Now, the actual bridge cycle of how myosin combines with actin, breaks, recombine, breaks, is not well known in smooth muscle, so we're not going to go into it. And there is only one thing about smooth muscle that I just want to say, that if you have an action potential in smooth muscle, it's like a pacemaker action potential, and that is caused by calcium and not sodium. So a spike or an action potential in smooth muscle is caused by a calcium in. In skeletal muscle and nerves, it's caused by sodium. But in pacemakers and smooth muscle in general, where there is an action potential, the spike is due to calcium. Now, I would like to leave smooth muscle and talk about skeletal muscle, but before I do that, let me ask their questions before I go on. Yeah?
In the diagram, it seems that there's a lot of these varicocytes, pretty much one for every bundle. Have gap junctions attached. They need to have sort of like one varicose for...
His question is, why do you have multiple varicosities for a single cell? Wouldn't one be enough? Maybe one would, but this is the way the setup is. I think that the answer, again, is that why would you have more than one varicosity? Even though this is a small cell, you have to be sure that the signal enters at multiple points to be sure that the whole cell gets triggered. That's the rationale for it. But the real answer is this is the way it is. Yes?
Aren't varicosities only in the pacemaker cells of the smooth muscle?
Are the varicosities only in the axons that contact the pacemaker cells? If this muscle has pacemaker cells, I think that's right. But exactly the setup in each smooth muscle is a little bit different. But his point is correct, that if you generate an action potential in the pacemaker cells, that will set off the rest, and you don't need to contact all the cells. Yes?
Did you say that a given cell could have both kinds of receptors on it?
Could a given cell have both kinds of receptors? Yes. Well, I think a given cell can have both norepinephrine and acetylcholine receptors. Certainly a muscle can. That is, a muscle composed of many individual cells can, as this picture shows. But whether an individual cell has both, I don't know the answer. I suspect that in a multi-unit muscle, it can. In single-unit muscle, there is no need for each individual cell to get input from both the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. If the joined operation gets input from both, that's enough. Other questions? Okay, so this is sort of the idea of how smooth muscle works, most of the critical things that we know. How does it work in skeletal muscle? Well, it's a little easier to explain this if we look first at structure, which we have avoided so far. So that's why we have that handout on A. If you turn it the other way, you have the basic structure here set up of a skeletal muscle. Now, each individual skeletal muscle cell is very large and multinucleate, as we've explained before. And this is a single fiber or a single skeletal muscle cell, but it's very large. Now, in it are individual what are called myofibrils. Now, I think the best demo for this involves bread, but as I said, I didn't bring it because this is the eighth day of Passover, that you can think of this as being a package of breadsticks. And this, a single breadstick, is a myofibril. But the individual cell is packed with breadsticks. Now, the actin and myosin are aligned in each myofibril, and the myofibrils are aligned with each other, and that's why you get this striped pattern. And the striped pattern holds for the whole muscle, but it also holds for each myofibril. So let's look at what a myofibril looks like. And you have these dark patches in pairs. And then you have a line in between. Now, these are due to the actin and myosin business. And these lines here are what we've called the Z line. This is where the actin is attached. And this pattern repeats. So one repeat is called a sarcomere. Now, these dark areas are where the actin and the myosin, the thin and the thick filaments, overlap. The lighter areas are where you have only one or the other, only actin or only myosin. And people call this part, these are all labeled on your handout, the part from one dark to the next is called the I band. And the part that's between sort of darks, and then this part is called the A. They're labeled there. And the only thing that isn't labeled there, which might be worth it, is in the middle of the A band, you see there's a light area. That light area is where you have myosin and no actin. So that's called the H zone. Now, if we blow it up and we look at one sarcomere, that's what's underneath that shows you have the actual actin and myosin on. So they draw the Z line as a wiggle before I drew it as a straight line. And remember, the actin is attached to the Z line. So you put, they put the actin in like this. You get the idea. And it's drawn as a thin line. Remember, actin is the thin filament. Myosin is the thick one. Now, so that's the actin, and it's attached to the Z. The Z line is made up of multiple proteins, which we won't specify. So this is the actin. And now I'm going to put in the myosin. And the myosin has these little heads on it, on the two ends, which is why it's drawn the way it's drawn. And that's also what makes it thicker. So this is the myosin. And a sarcomere then goes from one Z to the next. Now, how do you get the striped pattern? You can see that right through this part, there's both myosin and actin overlapping. And the same over here. But there's a space in the middle that has myosin but no actin. So this space right here is the H zone. Myosin but no actin. Now, where do we have actin but no myosin? You notice you have that here at the ends. There's a space next to the Z line that has only actin. And it actually goes on both sides. That's the I band. So the I band is here. Now, what's going to happen when it contracts? So we have the same model we brought last time, where the green is the myosin and the red is the actin. So this is the relaxed version. So when I contract it, the H zone in the middle gets shorter. The half and I band over here on the sides gets shorter. But the myosin and the actin stay the same. But the overlap region changes when I contract and I relax. Okay. So now we want to blow it up and look a little more closely at actin and myosin. Before I do that, are there any questions about this picture? Yeah.
So the I band, are you saying the Z line is part of it?
Okay, so the I band, the Z line is in the middle of the I band. So the Z line is considered part of it. Yeah. So let's see how this looks molecularly. You want to turn your hand out over and look at the other side. And particularly, you want to look at the top left, which is a blow-up of myosin and a blow-up of actin. Well, actin is easy, but this is the best I could do for myosin here. A myosin fiber has many myosin molecules, and each myosin molecule is sort of like a fork in that it has a sort of head at an angle. And so you have a bunch of them together. So there's a part in the middle, which is just like the fork handles, which has no heads. And then on the ends, you have heads. Now, a real myosin fiber would have many, many individual myosins. So it would have a huge number of forks in it. This only has four. So there would be heads sticking out all the way along this side, and multiple heads sticking out all the way along this side, as shown in your picture. But it's three-dimensional. So there are heads sticking out all the way around on each end. So you can contact actin over here, actin over here, actin all the way around. And similarly, there are heads sticking out all the way around on the other end. Now, what does actin look like? Now, the proportions are not right here. This is much bigger. But you remember we said actin consists of a chain of globular actins, and then the two are twisted around each other to make fibrous actin. So an actin or a thin filament, the basic actin part looks like this. But in a thin filament, as shown on your handout, there's actually two other proteins that are very important. And they are tropomyosin and troponin. So I'm going to write them both down. These are only in scale. These tropomyosin is found in both, but Now, remember we said in smooth muscle, what is it that binds calcium? It's calmodulin. But in striated muscle, it's troponin that binds the calcium in skeletal muscle. However, that leaves to the movement of tropomyosin, which leads to the ability of actin to bind. So maybe we should write that out. Another way to say it is, for smooth muscle, we had to alter the myosin so it would stick to the actin. In skeletal muscle, we have to modify the actin so it will stick to the myosin. And the reason for that, if you look at your picture of actin, you notice that the protein tropomyosin goes all the way along the length of each chain of actin. And the tropomyosin covers up the sites where actin would stick to myosin. So you have your actin, and the tropomyosin is on top. Now, the place where actin and myosin would get it together is underneath here. So the myosin can't get to the actin, and they can't get it together. The job of the calcium is to see that you push the tropomyosin away. And as a result, you expose the binding sites on the actin. So if you add calcium, what happens is, I'll just draw it this way, you move the tropomyosin, and now the binding sites for myosin are exposed. But in order for that to work, calcium has to bind to a protein that changes conformation that gives the elbow to the tropomyosin. And the protein that calcium actually binds to is troponin. You note that troponin on your picture has three parts because it has three jobs. What does troponin do? Well, it has to stick to actin. But it also has to stick to tropomyosin, and it has to bind calcium. And apparently each part of it does one of those. So the troponin is under here somewhere. And when it binds calcium, it changes conformation, and it pushes the tropomyosin away. So this time, I erased what we had here, but from the point of view of the two of these, if you want to get contraction in smooth muscle, which protein do you have to alter? Myosin or actin? You have to alter the myosin, but in the case of skeletal muscle, you have to alter the actin. Now, when you alter the myosin, how do you do it? Covalent, change conformation. You have to phosphorylate the myosin, so that's covalent. But you only change the conformation of the actin complex. And the protein that binds calcium then, as you just told me, is calmodulin versus troponin. Okay. So let's suppose we can do it. Calcium comes along, calcium binds to troponin, the troponin pushes the tropomyosin, and now the actin is ready to bind myosin. Well, no. We're going to have to split some ATP in order to get the myosin and actin to move relative to each other. Now, this is true for smooth muscle, too. Once you phosphorylate myosin, to go through any bridge cycle, you have to break ATP. But we're going to explain how that works for skeletal because it's better known. And that's what the bottom picture... first of all, we want to look at the top right, and then we'll look at the bottom. Now, on the top right in the little corner of your handout is a picture of a single sarcomere. And all we've drawn there is one actin and one pair of actins. Here are Z lines. And one pair of actins and one myosin. And to keep it simple, the myosin has only one head on each side. But the actin has three binding sites. 1, 2, 3. Now, this is the relatively relaxed state. Now, what's going to happen in the contracted state is we're going to take the two myosins, we're going to bend them over till they hit the twos, and then we're going to straighten them up again. And when we do that, we're going to get the picture underneath. The myosin is the same length it was before, although the pictures may not be perfect. The actin, however, is the same length as it was before, but it's moved over further. So if I drew it right now, before the myosin was under the number one binding sites, and now it's under the twos. Now, what got shorter? The actin and the myosin didn't. Well, there's more overlap now. The area of overlap is larger, but this would be half of the I band over here. That got shorter. Because the area with no overlap is shorter, and the area in the middle with no overlap got shorter. Now, how this works is blown up on the bottom where all we've drawn is this part. Except we started actually with this one. We started with the myosin head under number two. How does it move over to number three? Now, it's not really the myosin moves, it's the actin. The myosin bends, contacts the actin, and pushes the actin in. So how does it do that? So that's what the little boxes on the bottom allow you to go through. Now, what we're talking about here is a contraction cycle. And since this is a cycle, it means that we can start anywhere. So I'm actually going to start with B and not with A. So if you look at B here, you see you have actin, which is attached to the Z line. And then you have the myosin underneath. And now the myosin has been bent back. So the myosin is under position 3. It's not connected. Now, in order to get some action, the myosin is going to connect to position 3, and then the myosin is going to straighten up. And when the myosin straightens up, that's going to push the actin to the left, and the muscle's going to contract. Now, why did I start here? When there's no calcium, this is what your muscle looks like. When there's no calcium, your myosin sits around ready to contact your actin, but it doesn't do it. Why doesn't the myosin stick to the actin? Well, I think I erased the wrong picture. Because remember that actin is covered with tropomyosin. And this blocks the sites where the myosin would go. So this is the actin, and this is the tropomyosin. So calcium has to come along and bind to troponin to push the tropomyosin out of the way and expose the binding sites on the actin, so now the myosin can stick to it. So that's what calcium does. Calcium binds to troponin, pushes the tropomyosin, exposes the actin, and now we get C. So now the myosin can actually stick to the actin. But then once it does that, then we get D. Then the myosin straightens up. Well, if the myosin straightens up, you're going to get step D. Now, just to be sure you understand the picture, this is actually the end of the actin. Is this the end of the myosin? Remember, this myosin really continues all the way across to the other half. The actin does not. Okay, so what you're looking here is just the right half of that little picture on the top. Now, this stage then has to go back to the beginning. What do we have to do next? We have to detach the actin and the myosin so we can cock the myosin and do it again. So the next stage, which leads to E, is that now we have the myosin unattached to the actin. This is E. But if you've been following your picture, you see it's the same as A. The only difference is in A, except if I did this right, this would be number 4, which isn't in your picture. No, it's under 3. That's right. That's under 3. But in this picture, it's under 2. So if we take it from the top on your handout, originally the myosin was under position 2. Then we bent it back and cocked it. Then we attached it to position 3. Then we let it straighten up and move the actin over. And then we detached it, and now it's under 3. Yeah?
What causes the myosin head to bend back?
Okay. Now, if you're going to pull all of this, somebody's moving around, right? That takes energy. Where does the energy come from? ATP. So that's what we have to put in here next. You're absolutely right. We need some ATP in here to do it. Now, this is a cycle. And I chose to start at the point where when you add calcium, you get some action. But where does the ATP come in? We could start anywhere. But actually, what you need ATP for is this step right here. You need ATP to detach myosin from actin. Then you have to split ATP in order to do the cocking. But the ATP is still there. Both the ADP and the PI are both bound to myosin. But they've been separated, and the energy has been used to cock the myosin. And then, in the next step, we're going to lose the ADP and the PI. And let me be sure I have it down right, because I think I'm missing one. Okay. So to cock it, you have to split, right? Then you have to split the ATP. And then to contact... Yeah, oh no, I put the ATP in the wrong place. That's why it doesn't work. You need the ATP here. You need the ATP in order to detach actin and myosin. You actually lose the phosphate in one step, and you lose the ADP in the next one. So by the time you get to the actin straight attached to myosin and the myosin straight, there is no ATP left for this bridge. Now, the consequences of all this is, in a normal living cell, do you run out of ATP? You don't. Do you run out of calcium? Yes, remember calcium's kept very low? After you get the signal to contract, the calcium is all cleaned up and pumped back into the ER, which is called the sarcolemma, or the SR, in many muscle cells. So the calcium is cleaned up. So the calcium comes in pulses. But the ATP is almost always there. Now, after you die, heaven forbid, you've all heard of rigor mortis. Rigor mortis sets in because you run out of ATP. There's a lot of calcium around because the calcium is released from the ER and there's no ATP pump to put it back. So there's calcium around. So because there is calcium, you go through this step. And then you go straighten up. But now there's no ATP. So if there is no ATP, it is impossible to detach the actin from the myosin. And this is what causes rigor mortis. The muscles are locked. Because in the absence of ATP, you can't get the actin away from the myosin. Now, eventually it wears off because the muscle falls apart. But in the beginning, that's the problem. All right.
Yes. To reset back to, do you use the ADP from that second ATP?
No. What happens to this ADP?
No. You're on position 3 in E, then you go back to position 2 in A.
Well, these two are really exactly the same, except A and E are exactly the same, except the myosin is moved over one relative to the actin.
Okay, so you have
no relaxation. No, so you just start all over again. Now, this illustrates this business about the latch state that we mentioned before, that if you have ATP in a cell, then it is impossible to remain in this actin contracted with myosin state. If you want to keep the muscle contracted, you have to break it, break the bridge, make it, break the bridge, make it, break the bridge, make it. This is different in smooth muscle. In smooth muscle, you can apparently hold the bridge longer, although it's not clear how. So what would happen in a normal muscle if there was no more impulse? Where would the cycle stop? No more input means no more calcium. So that means we would go around up to here. We would bind ATP. We would split the ATP. But then the muscle is cocked and ready to go, but it wouldn't do anything until the calcium came around again, and then we would go through the cycle. Now, if you go back to 19C, there is one more feature here that we want to fit in. We know that muscles can contract more or less. They don't always contract the same amount. There was a question?
Yes. So
do you need ATP to contract and to relax? You can look at it that way, yes. In the absence of ATP, you are stuck in the contracted state. But to start the cycle again, to run the cycle, you need the energy of ATP to actually make the bridge. Now, if you look at the top pictures on your handout now, it compares the contraction and the action potential. In the very first picture, there's an action potential in the muscle membrane. And then here, it shows you what happens. This is the action potential. This is the contraction. Now, the point of this is that the contraction is quite long relative to the action potential. So the muscle starts to contract. I can stimulate it again before it has finished, and it will contract even more. And I can stimulate it again before it is contracted, finished, and it will contract even more until it reaches a maximum. But if you look underneath, the picture is different for the heart. In the picture underneath, it shows you the action potential for the heart. This is skeletal muscle, and this is the heart. And then here is the muscle. Now, what's the point of this? You can cause a muscle to contract and then kick it and make it contract again until, in fact, it's contracted as far as it can, which is called tetanus. Can you get your heart muscle contracted maximally and stuck? I hope not. And the reason is because you can't trigger it to contract again until it's finished contracting. The action potential lasts so long that by the time the action potential is over and the refractory period is ended and you can trigger it again, the muscle has already contracted. And this is due to difference in the channels in the two. Now, rather than go into that, which we may do when we get to the heart, I want to go back and consider one thing that I forgot. And that is, how does the calcium in skeletal muscle reach all the way through this entire cell? The calcium is sequestered, as we've indicated, inside the ER. So if we draw, here's the membrane. The ER is down here. If you get an action potential in the membrane of a muscle, of a skeletal muscle, how does that cause a release of calcium inside the cell? The answer is that you have, in fact, invaginations of the membrane, which go down next to the ER. And the action potential goes all the way down, and changes in the membrane open channels in the ER. Now, the best model for this... Okay. Is that what does one of these invaginations or tubules look like? It looks like what you'd get if you actually took one of these fingers and just pushed it all the way in, which I'm not doing too well today. Okay. So if I take one of these and I push it all the way in, I need a big one because I got a big finger. And if you pushed it all the way inside, that's what one of those tubules would be like. And so the surfaces, the membrane of that tubule, goes right near the surface of the ER. And so changes in the voltage in this membrane cause the opening of channels in the ER, and that causes the release of calcium throughout the cell. And these are called T-tubules. Now, you don't need them in smooth muscle because the smooth muscle cells are so small. But in skeletal muscle, you have them going into the muscle from all sides. And they connect with the ER. And therefore, you can change the calcium in time, the entire cell, and cause all of the fibers to contract together. Now, I want to mention a little bit that next time, rather than continue this with heart muscle, Dr. Solomon Moshowitz, the XY Moshowitz, is going to talk about immunology. I am scheduled to go to a meeting which was originally supposed to be in February, but it was snowed out and rescheduled. And therefore, I pretty much have to go, but Solomon will cover on Thursday, and since he teaches immunology, just as you got a little flavor of development and a little flavor of physiology, of in neuro, you'll get a little taste of immunology starting on Thursday. All of the exam information will be posted by Friday. And note that I don't have office hours on Thursday because I won't be here, and that there is a special documentary about malaria today. Let me just turn this off.